Hello and welcome back to another episode of A Need to Read, You Absolute Legends. Before we get into today's episode, I have an admission to make. I feel like I haven't kept up to date with technology. I feel that at some point in my life, I kind of took a nap and I've woken up and it's 2020 and the internet is everywhere and it rules my life. I remember when I used to go home from school and I'd run home and then I'd just listen to this. And I'd go about my daily internet business, which included some instant messaging and going on a really early form of social media. Whereas now it's just touches every part of my life, technology and the internet. And I think it's mental. So I'm a bit scared. But the good news is for you, because I am scared, I've decided that I need to speak to an expert. And that is why I managed to get Azeem Azhar onto the podcast. Now, he is one of the most trusted voices in technological innovation, which is quite an impressive title, by the way. And he's been working in the tech industry since the early 90s, since probably before I was born, with companies like the BBC, The Guardian, The Economist. So he's kind of a big deal. Now, most recently, he's become like a startup investor, as most tech entrepreneurs would do. But he's advised as well to the World Economic Forum. He's contributed to publications like the Financial Times, MIT Technology Review, and he produces the Exponential View newsletter, which has over 200,000 subscribers, including some like real leaders in the industry, like Daniel Ek, who's like the CEO of Spotify. Having run that newsletter for a couple of years, Azeem decided that it was time to write a book, and Exponential is his book that we're talking about today in a roundabout way, about how technology has become so advanced so rapidly and the different ways in which the individual human, businesses, politics and warfare are struggling to keep up with how rapidly technology goes on. So I guess this is quite an intense podcast, but it is a really good one. And I think these are things that are important for us to know about. We have kind of an obligation to ourselves to learn about technology and at least get like a basic understanding, even though it's hard. So to push yourself intellectually a little bit to get a good understanding on it so that you're not left behind in society, which would be a terrible thing, is quite a good idea. Now, before I hand over to the conversation with myself and Azeem, which is where we talk about what the exponential age actually is and it means, we talk about the metaverse, how technology is getting cheaper and what that means for society, clean energy, cyber security. We talk about Russia, because obviously I would ask about that. And then a little bit about would we ever need to be suspicious about living in a simulation? Before that, you just have to hear about the sponsors of the show. Now, in the description of the show, you can check out the sponsors. It's BetterHelp and Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens is a green shake that I have every single morning. You can get a year's free supply of vitamin D3 with them with a subscription and 5 free travel packs by being a Need to Read listener. Details of that are in the description of the show. And the podcast is also sponsored by BetterHelp. BetterHelp have supported the show for a really long time. They've supported 3 million people plus with online therapy around the world. And honestly, if you're looking to get psychological help, firstly, well done to you. Hats off. It's a tough decision to come to, but secondly, have a look at BetterHelp. It's one of the cheapest ways that you can get it for effective therapy, and to be matched with a counsellor who suits your needs is quite convenient, because looking through other modes of looking, it can take a long time, and that puts some people off. So if you're looking to get online therapy, head to BetterHelp, go to betterhelp.com/a need to read, and you can get 10% off your first month. But without further ado, let's hand over to me and Azeem. People listening will have heard of the Stone Age and the Industrial Age and the Iron Age. And
right.
Before I read your book, I thought we're in the, oh dear, look at what we're doing age. But you say it's the exponential age. So what does it mean to be in the exponential age? And could you, in words, plot that on a graph for people that don't understand what an exponential growth is?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do we mean by ages? Anyway, they're sort of slightly artificial constructs, but they are about saying that when you're in a particular age, the structures and the processes and the experience is distinctly different to the age that you had before. And we've often, so as you say, you know, we've anchored them on kind of particular types of technologies. And, you know, you don't move from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age because you run out of stones. You move there because you figure out how to fashion things out of bronze. So I'm arguing in the exponential age that the sort of fundamentals of the technologies and the way that they interact change sufficiently over the period before that it will feel distinctly different to the one that we had, and it'll be much less recognizable, and in that way force kind of new behaviors if we want to live in the world in a sort of reasonable way. And what does exponential mean in all of that, as distinct from, say, industrial, is the idea that the technologies that we are going to deal with are improving really, really rapidly, and we can make some sort of assumptions on that speed of change. And it's, you know, if I told you that, if I told you that we are going to go for a nice walk on a sunny day at maybe 2.5 miles an hour, you'd wear a different set of sunglasses or hat to the one that I might say to you, we're going to be in a convertible racing down the autobahn at 130, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have different experience. You're going to sort of dress differently. And that, I think, is what I was trying to get across in the book. What do we mean by exponential? We mean that, an exponential function is distinct to a linear function in that every incremental time step that you have, you grow by a similar proportion, which means it's bigger each time. So it's a little bit like bank account interest. You know, if in the old days when I was a child, I could get 10% interest in my bank account because interest rates were so high. And that would mean that if I had 100 quid in my bank account, which I never did, after 1 year, I'd have 110. The second year, I'd have 121 because I'd have 10% of 110, which is 11. And the year after that, it'll be 132 and some change. Mm. And the increment is increasing constantly, and compounding interest is really, really powerful. And it's an exponential function. And it's distinct to linear functions where I have £100 one year, then 102, then 104, then 106. Actually, I'm getting a declining growth rate there because £2 on £100 is 2%, but £2 on £110 is less than 2%.
Yeah.
And the technologies that I was looking at have this exponential characteristic about them in different ways, which is essentially they're getting cheaper by a kind of constant high percentage between 10 and 20 or 30 or 50 or 60 or 70% every single year on a compounding basis. So it's really hard for us to wrap our heads around it. And you know, the COVID pandemic showed that because pandemics go through periods where they have these short exponential growth phases. And when you go through that, you may remember the government sort of going, oh, well, there were 200 people infected today. Mm-hmm. And then a week later, they go, well, it was 20,000 today. Yeah. That's the exponential phase because you can't, it's really hard for us to understand how that that process accelerates. And more prosaically, compound interest, this exponential function, is really powerful. Our pension pots benefit from compound interest. Mm. So the rule is start saving early, it's going to be worth a lot. And we all save up for our pensions too late, because we don't understand the exponential function well enough. And the thing about these technologies is that they're in that growth rate. And so I'll give you one example of that. Mm. Lithium ion batteries, which are the batteries that live in cell phones and mobile electric vehicles. These things used to cost about $1,200. This is 2010 or so, per kilowatt hour. So that is the sort of unit of storage of energy.
Yeah.
By 2020, they cost about $140 per kilowatt hour because they were declining in price exponentially over that time. And they've continued to do that. And that is hard to understand and hard to accept, because that is not what's happening with the price of beer.
Yeah, it's frustrating that, because there's a few examples in the book that I loved. And I think it was transistors that started in, I want to say, 58 at 150, and then by 72, they're like 15 cents.
Yeah, so well, let's build on that. So in 1958, they cost about $1,200 in 2020 terms. So it's $150 at the time,
yeah,
$1,200 or $1,400 in today's terms. For $1 today, you'd be able to pick up between 10 and 100 million transistors. Because you've got, in my iPhone, there are probably 100 billion transistors kicking around between the central processing unit, the graphics unit, and the memory chips. And so that is the price decline. And what is a transistor? A transistor is the basic fundamental switching unit within a computer that allows computation to take place or on which computation occurs. And, you know, my first computer, which I've got here, I'm holding up, listeners, the ZX81 from 1981, has a few thousand transistors in it. And from that, you can produce a computer that can compute anything. It's Turing complete. And of course, our computers now have billions of transistors in them. They're much faster. Mm. They're much more powerful. And maybe just to wrap that idea up.
Yeah.
So when I was 13, the world's most powerful computer was a Cray 2 supercomputer. This was 1985. That computer cost a few million dollars back in 1985, and it was the size of a house, it was the size of a big, big living room, and required tons of electricity. And I really wanted one, and my parents wouldn't get me one, for obvious reasons, because literally only the US military and the Met Office had them, and they're super expensive. And yet I do effectively have one, because my Apple Watch Series 6 is, which I got for free when I changed my mobile phone tariff, is twice as powerful as a Cray 2 from 1985. Wow. And that is what we kind of contend with, right? And the sort of declining prices.
God, it makes you sweat. Honestly, reading through the book and trying to wrap my head around these exponential changes in like how much cheaper things are getting and how much better they're getting. Like I remember the example of the first computer that beat someone at chess, and that was apparently the size of a football pitch. I don't know if that's true, a pretty big computer, and it costs like quite a lot of money, whereas now if I go on chess.com, any computer can beat me easily. I'm not a grandmaster, but it's quite a difference. So these advances are obviously everywhere now. I'd just like to know from you one that you're wary of and one that you're really excited for, to like see how they develop.
You know, I'm really interested in the kind of fundamental technologies themselves, the silicon chips, the transistors, the quantum bits, the battery chemistries, and so on. I mean, I think that's where the opportunity emerges. That's really close on the frontier research. It's kind of close to maths, actually, increasingly. So where things get composed into things that are closer to applications are where I think you start to get to areas of a little bit of nervousness. So start with a sort of nervous one that makes me a bit I'm a bit meh about is a lot of what people are talking in about in terms of sort of how the metaverse is currently being kind of conceived. Yes. So the idea behind the metaverse is that somehow if you ask three different metaverse leaders in different companies, they'll give you different definitions depending on what suits them. So nobody really knows, but we know that there could be money in it. So the reason I feel a bit meh about it is because it's being driven by a need by companies in particular like Facebook and some of the gaming companies to find new ways or new platforms where they can make money rather where they can deliver value. And it's not that I don't think people need entertainment, and it's not that kids don't enjoy playing Fortnite or Roblox. Mm. It's just there are so many more important things for us to be getting on with. and a space which is driven by hedonic satiety, yep, rather than people doing hard shit that matters, is why we get where we are today, right? Whatever that is, right? So,
it's a brave new world.
Well, yes, I mean it is, right? So in that soma sense, right? Mm. So we'll dull the senses, or it's a kind of Marxist opium, right? And so I find that really, I mean, technically I can see that it's really interesting. I think it's a little bit unhelpful because it's taking a lot of oxygen and it's taking a lot of talent. That isn't to say that in 20 to 30 years, will virtual experiences and the fusion of the physical world and the digital world be really, really important? I'm sure it will be, and it will be in really, really, really sensible and useful ways. We will, we'll train people through it, or we will be able to manage resources far better. We'll simulate things that we don't need to kind of physically use resources for, and so on. But the way that it's currently driven, which is this is a new way for X consumer brand to sell shampoo with a celebrity in a 3D avatar while you wear your VR goggles, is really kind of awful. So that's, and again, I'm not even putting bounds around what happens to humanity in terms of our relationship with the technology, and how does it change us, and how do we change that? I mean, I'm not saying that's a problem in of itself. That's going to happen in some way, because it always has happened. But I'm just saying the way that it's currently manifested, I think is not helpful and not useful and shouldn't be a priority. And I spent some time looking at it. I mean, I've been doing things in VR, and like for 25 years, I ran a team that looked at its feasibility a few years ago as well at a different company. But what I'm excited about, I mean, there are all the banner technologies that are exciting, like quantum computing, which, if we get it, should be able to really, really tackle hard problems around climate change and around resource availability and so on. Nuclear fusion would also be able to do that. But I think there's something really interesting happening within nuclear fission. Nuclear fission is the way that currently nuclear power is generated. It has a really bad rap, even though by its environmental load in terms of kind of CO2, it's actually in some sense cleaner than wind and solar, because you don't have to do all the mining of the lithium and build all the concrete for the wind turbines and so on. And in terms of its fatality rate, it's much, much lower than coal or gas or anything else. Yeah. And in fact, it's an incredibly safe form of power. But what happened in the nuclear power world was that the design of those reactors is such that in order to be made safe, you need to spend billions of dollars in regulation and concrete sarcophagi to live around them. So they didn't enjoy the learning rates that exponential technologies did. But in the 50s and 60s, physicists came up with new physics and new chemistry for nuclear reactors, things called small modular reactors, which are kind of inherently safe by design. And they're actually much, much cheaper were we to get through the regulatory headaches and the monopoly power of the existing firms. And I'm quite excited about the possibility of this sort of inherently safe form of generating electricity becoming more commonplace over the coming 10 or 15 years. Because a lot of our issues actually come back to how much energy do we have and how much waste do we generate in creating that energy? And there was a turning point in the 17th century when we started to be able to use fossil fuels, the first coal coming out of the UK. And we got much more energy, obviously, with great waste. And we've had that trade-off. We're not ready to become an energy-poor species yet. Far from it. We want to be more and more energy-rich. And even things like, how do you tackle the climate crisis? A large part of that can be resolved with more clean energy, not because we replace dirty energy, that's helpful, but because the cost of maintaining biodiversity, or let's more prosaically say the cost of eliminating excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is fundamentally one of an energy expensive process, which is grabbing the CO2 out of the atmosphere and sticking it somewhere else. So if you have lots of free clean energy, you can afford to do that. When you don't have enough of it, it's very expensive to do. So I'm really excited about energy technologies, in particular, the idea of the small modular reactor, which has which is inherently safe by design, and because of its size and scale, is highly, highly appropriate for places in the world which suffer from deep, deep energy poverty. So just imagine the poorest 4 billion people on the planet.
Yeah, and in those areas, a lot of those are burning wood, which is obviously terrible for the environment, right? And it's also like inside their homes, so allowing them access to cleaner energy is super important for their health and for the planet.
Well, yeah, I would say that the thing, if you actually look at where the emissions come from, for example, they're coming from the sort of richer world and the soon to be rich world, as opposed to the world that's burning wood.
It's propaganda, you know, I fell for then.
Yeah. I mean, it's coming from, you know, the US and Europe and then China. And then places like sort of Russia with big populations and sort of no kind of environmental standards. One of the things that I point out in the book is that these exponential technologies like renewables and computing have actually helped make our economies much, much more climate friendly. So the amount of CO2 that the UK economy puts out into the atmosphere for the pounds of GDP it generates has declined dramatically. 30 or 40%, I forget the exact number. Somewhere in the book. The reason for that is that new industrial processes, especially when they're computer controlled, are just much more efficient.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, 30% of our electricity is now generated through clean processes like offshore wind. And so, what you do have is a path through these technologies for to dramatically reduce the carbon footprint while increasing the energy output and maintaining sort of the economic welfare that people want. It doesn't, of course, actually kind of fundamentally answer the question of, what happens with resource usage and pollution, because even if I reduce my carbon footprint by 99%, from an economic perspective, for every pound of GDP we create, if we increase our GDP by a factor of 200, we'll be putting out twice as much carbon dioxide in absolute numbers, right? And nature doesn't care about the relatives, it cares about the absolute. We haven't answered that question. It's called the rebound effect. It makes tackling the problem much, much easier. I mean, and I think that's the beauty of some of these technologies, is that they do dramatically enable us to answer those harder questions.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think what you said you're a little bit wary of in relation to my next question. Before I went to bed last night, I scrawled on a little piece of paper and it says, Google knows us better than we know ourselves. And this is something that I'm not necessarily terrified of all of the time, but I am a little bit of a time. So can you explain how these tech firms who have a lot of data on individuals, how that works, the models they create, and why we should be concerned about that, basically?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we're not as unpredictable as we would like to, think we are.
No.
We have very, very... sort of individually repeatable patterns, and we're also quite like other people. And there was a fascinating survey done by YouGov, which is a polling company in the UK, I think just after Brexit. And it was, they just, all they did was they correlated certain kind of consumer products with whether you're a Leaver or a Remainer, right? And if you liked Branston's pickle and HP sauce, you were much more likely to be a Leaver. And if you liked, I think it was kind of Virgin Atlantic, right, as an airline, you were much more likely to be a Remainer. And so we, you know, we're not as predictable as we would like to think we are. We send out all sorts of different types of signals. What has happened over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years has been that we have digitized much more of our behaviors, and companies realized that having access to that digital data about behaviors in general would allow them to produce better and better products. So when you look at a company like Google, they started with very, very sort of naive, what we think of today, sense that you would crawl the web and you would look at the structure of the web and how pages point to each other in order to help us make sense of that. And they started to realize that their machine learning algorithms, which are bits of software that effectively learn from the patterns of the data that they see, this isn't magic. This is just about, as simple as if I showed you six men, one of them is 5'1" and five are 6'8", and I said, point to the one who's not going to be so good at basketball. It's quite easy for you to do that, right? It's the 5'1" person. And, you know, point to the one who's going to be a better jockey is the same thing, right? And then, there might be confounding factors in all of that, of course, but in general, you'd be right there. And so these sort of correlations exist. And what Google realized quite early on, there's a very famous scientific paper called the Unreasonable Effectiveness of Data, was that you can get better and better predictions from more and more data, even if you use simple maths. So in order to build a kind of amazing system that could be help you search the web better, you were almost better with a kind of naive piece of maths and loads of data, and the more data, the better, than you were with a really sophisticated algorithm and much less data. And the most modern AI systems, these sort of deep neural networks that have started to emerge in 2012, do even better with more and more data. And so there's a kind of fundamental sort of scientific reason why that excess of data is really, really valuable if you sort of don't ask questions about, like, what are the social impacts of it. And this notion that Google therefore knows us better than we might know ourselves is because what we do through our kind of web interactions and is a revealed preference. So even if you say you never read the Daily Mail, because you're above that. Yeah. For those listeners who are not in the UK, the Daily Mail is a sort of tabloid newspaper, which is very famous on the web for having this thing on the right called the sidebar of shame with all these salacious stories. So you might go at your hoity-toity dinner party and say, listen, I only read Baudrillard when I'm not reading Aristophanes. And I would never touch the Daily Mail. But Google or the web knows better because they know that you're looking at the sidebar of shame, in my case, four times a day. And that's a revealed preference. And but the thing is that there's all of this stuff can be tied together and can be connected. And a lot of it is delivered for us, for our benefit. And you may have noticed this, right? When you start to go on a plan for a holiday and you're starting to think, well, let me find interesting cafes near Lyon, the command completion within Google will start to put near Lyon as an option within a few queries. And that's really, really helpful. But that's only happening because of these kind of statistical correlations that it's running in the background. And because of the exponential age, those things used to 10 years ago take weeks to calculate, and now they take seconds to calculate. Yeah. And you get this much, much more nuanced approach. And you'll see it even with your GPS system now. You know, if you fire up Waze, and I fire up Waze and I'm at home, the top three results are my kids' schools. Whereas if I'm at my mum's house, the top result is my home. because it's already figuring out where I think I need to go. And of course, you know, the problem with all of that is about the sense that we might be manipulated into doing things that are not in our own benefit. And you're starting to see some legislation that is connected to sort of privacy legislation that is about putting the constraints on that sort of behavior. And in particular, starting to say, you can only use the data that you've gathered about a person for the purpose for which they asked you to gather the data. In other words, famously, about 7 or 8 years ago, a woman in America started to get coupons for baby products. Mm. And she didn't know she was pregnant, but her shopping patterns had sufficiently changed for people to figure out she was in her third trimester, end of her first trimester, whatever it happened to be. Yeah. And so finding, you know, this is where regulators can come in and they can say, look, we're now going to protect you. And we're going to say, we can only, data can only be used for the reasons for which you gave it to be used. Now, you know, there is obviously a cost to that, because in that example, it was a pregnancy thing. But let's say you could, through my shopping patterns, determine that I'm at stage one bladder cancer, right? Mm. So I don't know if you could. I'm just making that up, right? But just imagine that based on whether I was buying chewing gum or beer, you could work that out. Would it be helpful for me to get that alert and be told, listen, go and see your urologist straight away? It would be, but on the other hand, there is a cost to that level of invasion. And do I want my local supermarket being the one telling me that? And so we're starting to tackle those sorts of questions through regulation and starting to say, look, you should only gather the data for which it is really, really what I've asked you to do. And you know, we tend to point to Google as the sort of the bad guy in all of this, but which there's no doubt some sort of excesses in its behavior. I think Facebook happens to do much, much more. Mm. Apple does much less for a variety of reasons. But, you know, it's become so cheap and easy for companies to gather data that they do, even though it's useless. And so, you know, I've been buying some corrugated plastic roofing for my for a little mini shed thing I'm putting up at the back of the garden. Mm. And the company in question, with whom I will do one transaction in my life, has asked for my date of birth, right? And my a lot of data that they don't actually need. Yeah, you know, they don't actually need my address. The logistics company needs my address. They don't. And there would be ways in which that data could be, you know, transferred without my being involved. So for example, the problem is that now there is some roofing company. I don't know if they've got a 300 grand a year chief information security officer who's running regular audits on their cyber risk or not. My prediction is they haven't. And so my prediction is that my data is stored in clear text somewhere on one of their databases waiting to be hacked and then used against me. So that in of itself is a problem. And you know, so there are ways in which these sorts of things need to be tackled more, you know, more broadly. And it's not just about the, you know, the really, really big companies and what they know about us.
Yeah. And you mentioned that I personally feel quite powerless in relation to this next bit, but you've mentioned about collective action to kind of push back a little bit on these big companies who are using our data in ways that the average citizen just doesn't understand at all. What is it you mean by collective action? I obviously know what collective action means, but just in this particular instance, in relation to our data.
Well, I think there's a few different things that we can do. You know, one is around around the expression of choice. You know, the more that we use tools and that are made available to us, the more that is signaling to the companies that this is a product and a service that we need. I don't know how many people buy Apple products because of the privacy that they enable, but they should, right? If you care about that, you should know that, you know, a lot of the data that you put on your Apple phone or in iCloud is not accessible to Apple. You should know that that your health data as well is garnered and grounded in ways that are very, very different to the way that your Google searches, your Amazon search history is dealt with. And so in a sense, coming up to speed with those types of things and using the tools that are available, like, you know, occasionally, will clear my Google Maps history when I'm idle and just sort of go off and clear it, and I'll clear my, you know, whatever history, you know, from time to time. It's really expensive to do that as an individual to remember to do that. But part of the reason it's helpful is because these things remind the platforms that this is a consumer need, and they're always trying to serve that need in some way. But there are other types of collective action that become important. That includes how you engage in whatever expression or debate you have a platform for. I mean, I have a bigger platform than most people, so I can do more. Mm. But, you know, in a sense, we ended up here because we sleptwalk through what were important debates. And ultimately, you know, we're the ones who choose to watch Love Island rather than a YouTube video on privacy. Right. And so at some point, politics reflects people's expressions of interest. And even though the science had run far ahead of climate change, it was only until people started to express it politically that it starts to, you know, net zero shows up for better or worse on newspaper headlines. Mm. So I think that we as listeners have an ability to express that shift. And I'm not going to pretend that that any one voice changes what matters, but many voices do change that. But then there's a third wrapping of all of this, which is that there is such a benefit in collective data. It's so, you know, your data individually is not that interesting. Mm. It's data in aggregate that becomes really, really powerful, and there are so many benefits of it that we should be looking out for these collective approaches where they can help us. And a good example is the UK Biobank, which is run by Genomics England, amongst others. And what that's gone and done is it's got hundreds of thousands of gene sequences of people connected to their physical attributes, their height and their disease conditions and so on, their phenotypic expression, as it's called. And what that's allowed us to do is understand what genes express what conditions into what degree. And that is constructing a baseline for really, really improved medical interventions. And the thing about that is that that is not a database that is a kind of commercial database. It is almost a public good. Yeah. And there are many, many ways where we can kind of collectively start to contribute to things as public goods with our data. And what we have to do is we have to ask about whether the organization that is looking after that, whether they are actually acting in interests that we are aligned with. When we contribute our data to the Waze mapping system, or we contribute it to sort of Google's systems or Facebook systems, the exploitation of that is left up to those firms in ways that we might not necessarily agree with. And I think one thing that may change is that more of these data collectives will emerge over the coming years.
Yeah, and you mentioned there about the sequencing of the genome, just so the listeners can know what I know about it without hopefully they'll read the book, but if not,
I'm not going to tell them. They've got to read the book.
Yeah, good idea. Well, it's got way cheaper, everybody. Exponentially cheaper, some may say. So I just want to chat about Russia for a little bit. And Russia seems to do some dodgy stuff, which isn't out of character for them. But their cyber warfare and their social media propaganda campaigns, I have seen information about that before and thought that that might actually be propaganda against Russia. But you've obviously done the research on this. So how is Russia's cyber behavior at the moment impacting general citizens?
I mean, quite a lot, really. quite a lot. The issue with sort of cyber attacks is that we're all really, really vulnerable. In the sense that every computer or smart light bulb you buy is a potential vulnerability into your home network and into your systems. And there are lots of us who have got these things, 6 billion of us have got smartphones and email addresses and so on. Launching cyber attacks is really cheap because you can just send out 1 billion emails almost sort of cost free. So in that environment, you're going to see a lot of noise that is being created. And then you have this gray area between whether a cyber attack has actually been launched by the official military or by a kind of gray associated group, they've got all these cool names like Fancy Bear and Voodoo Bear and Strontium. And
they don't sound that scary.
Fancy Bear is particularly bad. They're sort of in a gray area between literally being part of the military or not. And then you just have criminal groups who use the tools. So if you think about an adversary who you want to destabilize, any of these tools are helpful. So you don't really care if you put a hacking tool that can support phishing emails into the hands of people who are just going to hit British citizens, right? Because that's making life worse for us, and it is constructing vulnerabilities within our society. So a lot of the tools do kind of emerge from that that pathway, and a lot of criminal groups are encouraged, tooled up by nation state actors. These tools are also, renowned for their collateral damage. A few years ago, NotPetya was a worm that was used to attack a Ukrainian bank. Almost certainly came from a GRU Russian sort of affiliated group, and NotPetya spread across the internet, and it brought down the computer systems of Mondelez, which is a big food company, and Maersk, which is a massive shipper, and had sort of real physical effects that ran into the billions of dollars, and so you also have this idea of the kind of collateral damage that emerges from it. So when you look at who's originating these broad-based cyber attacks, Russia and China are right at the top of the list. When you look at where they are, the kind of impact they're having, there's a proliferation. So every time there's a leakage or an NHS system goes down, it's happening because of the nature of proliferation of those technologies, or it's happening because it's a spillover of a specific style of attack. The pollution of the information sphere, it was, I think, largely we can connect it to those sort of state-based actors. Now, whether that actually made a difference in key votes is the 2016 Donald Trump election or the Brexit referendum, I mean, it seems to me slightly unlikely. There are other factors at play. However, did it was there some intention on questions like, I mean, I'll give you a couple of really effective examples. Mm. In the Syrian civil war, there was a lot of fake information and deliberate information operations against certain NGOs who were cataloguing war crimes, to the extent mm-hmm. that those NGOs ended up being blacklisted, even though as we look at them back up, we can see that they are, that happened as a result of very effective cyber information operations. Or the way in which you can connect similar accounts to the spread of vaccine misinformation at the start of COVID, I think you can start to see that it is viewed as a kind of legitimate warfighting domain. And given that in the UK, it's only been recently that we have started to see a rise in our defense spending, the move of resources away from kind of real aircraft and tanks into the cyber domain came at a cost when the cyber force was set up a few years ago. And why would the generals say we want to do this unless they felt that it actually was a sort of legitimate source of attack on our sovereignty and sort of citizen safety and so on? So, I mean, I take the view that it's an important domain, that the actions are intentional, that they have the effects they have. They may not have the extreme effects that the most extreme stories told us,
yeah,
that had the Russians not been around, Hillary Clinton would be president, or, you know, no. I mean, I'm not sure you can go that far. No. But I think you can see that it's a sort of legitimate space, and it's really difficult for us not to fall for it, because these things are really, really sophisticated. And I think every single one of us knows someone who has fallen for some kind of phishing scam and suffered some kind of loss.
Yeah, I did last year. Someone rang me from Monzo, and then he told me he was going to come to my house and sleep with my mother after I said, I'm not going to give you any more money.
That was then you realised.
Yeah, then I realised. I was like, oh, well, I never had that trouble with Lloyds. So we're coming to the end. I'd have one question that I would... I'm not sure if you would have been asked this before. I'm hoping not. But at what point should I feel concerned whether or not we might be living in a simulation if tech advances to a point so far?
Oh, I'm not sure it's going to matter if we're living in a simulation. You wouldn't know the difference, right? Where we currently are is that the simulations that are created for us are of such low quality and they're so manipulating that I think that is more in a way problematic. I take a sort of lens of, how do you take a lens of criticality and a sense of, you know, these interactions being about someone having power over you and wanting to extend that? And you ask that question of yourself, but equally you've got to live in the modern world, right? So you can't, if you start to doubt everything that you see all of the time, it becomes just quite hard to, you know, see your cousins or, or have, you know, and you end up where the Unabomber ended up with is a very, very detailed critique of the technosphere, which he started working on in the sort of 80s, and then ended up retreating into this sort of kind of cabin in the woods, saying, I don't want any of this. I mean, I think that these ideas of that interaction between political bureaucracy and scale industrial economies are not new ones. I think was it Weber who talks about the iron cage, right? This idea of the sort of rationalization of social life, because we have all these bureaucratic systems, whether they're within the civil service or whether it's the scale of industry, that demand a certain efficiency, and that efficiency demands fewer choices from us and greater predictability and greater sense of direction that is already mapped out, like our life stages get mapped out. And in the name of efficiency, that kind of constructs this iron cage for us. And that is the challenge, one of the challenges of modernity. I mean, we've been asking these questions for a really, really long time. And I think, so you have to find that balance between saying, do I trust what I'm seeing or do I not trust what I'm seeing? Mm-hmm. And if you do the former way, way, way too much, I think you end up in kind of a slightly difficult space of living a normal life. But if you don't do it enough, you sort of end up, I think, just as a hedonic, a sort of hedonic addict who needs to move from one experience to the next without asking what these experiences are for and why do they exist. So, I mean, I think you just have to find that balance.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's probably going to help me sleep at night. That's good. Yeah. sorry, just one final thing before I let you go. Obviously, your book is brilliant in relation to how technology is going to be affecting the world. Are there any other areas you think people should get a basic understanding of heading into the future? I would put your book right at the top of the list, by the way, because tech has been something that, obviously, you might be able to tell, I'm a bit worried about it. But reading your book has been like comforting as well as kind of scary. And it's good to get that dose of comfort through understanding.
I mean, I think there is so much that one can read at any given time. I mean, I think that if we just stick to nonfiction for the time being, Leia Upi's book Free, where she kind of talks about the decline, her experiences in childhood as Albania went from being the sort of Maoist country to chaotic, democratic capitalist country is really important in its sense also about how people persevere under and live lives under autocracies, but also about, what is the nature of freedom. I think it's a very, very clever book. It's a short book. It's highly readable. Yeah. I think also starting to dig into, histories becomes really, vital. A lot of the books that I read are histories, and in fact, probably the predominant number of them are. I'm just looking at what's on my shelf at the moment. So I've just also partway through Helen Thompson's Disorder, Helen Thompson is a professor of political economy at Cambridge, and her book is helping.
Red one, isn't it? I think I've got it on my shelf over there. I believe. The other day. Yeah.
But I think that she takes a much more of a geopolitical lens, and she's very, very deep in her understanding of institutional dynamics, and I think that's quite helpful to take that perspective as sort of distinct to mine, as a way of sort of painting your own picture of the world.
Yeah. Well, I can personally say that I'm buzzing that I already have read Free and own Disorder. So to be interested in the same books is a good feeling for me. So thank you for having that preference. Where can people find you and your work? I'll put links to anything you feel is relevant in the description of the episode for people.
So I am available on Twitter at Azeem, AZEEM, but of course if you Google Exponential View, you can sign up for my newsletter as well, which comes out a couple of times a week.
Awesome. All right, thank you so much, Azeem. That was a great chat.
Okay, pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for listening to that episode. You're absolute legends. Hopefully, you're not as terrified as I am of technology. If you want to understand a little bit more about it, a little bit about the exponential age, Azeem's book is really good. I wasn't that just saying it to him because I was being polite. I really did enjoy reading his book. It was slightly terrifying in stages, but it was also comforting to kind of get an understanding on it. So there's that. Update from me is I still really want you to subscribe to my mailing list, because the only way that I know if I'm any good is if you read them and don't unsubscribe. I haven't got particularly high standards for my validation, but that is kind of the standard. So you might as well see if you like it, because you can always unsubscribe. That option's always there. What else have I got for you? I recorded one of the first episodes of a new podcast series that will be separate from A Need to Read Today. That, if I can deliver on my promise to myself, will be in September, but it's obviously most likely not going to be there. So you can wait and see on that one. First place to hear about that will be my Good to Know mailing list, which you can find in the description of this episode. But I've wasted so much of your time telling you about my life. I hope you're well. Love you. Goodbye.